This is Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex. We'll continue now with our tour of 10 local food hotspots with James McKinnon and Alyssa Smith, authors of The 100 Mile Diet. Alyssa picks up with their observations from the months the couple spent in northern Spain. They stayed in a tiny village to learn about local food.
So a lot of people have an image of Europe as a local food paradise full of all kinds of traditional delicacies. I had that image. I certainly must admit that. But this summer, we spent 4 months in Spain, and we got up close and personal with a very traditional village in northern Spain. So I can kind of tell you, at least in that part of the world, what is true, what we can learn from them, but also that they have things that they can learn from us. And there's a lot of romanticizing that goes on when it comes to what they eat in Europe. This is the village that we stayed in for the summer, called Villanueva. There's probably only about 40 people live there, so we were a bit of an oddity when we arrived. But it's in the north of Spain. It's very much cooler than the rest of the country, mountainous, green, rainy. So in a way, it's hotter, but the climate's kind of like Vancouver. But here, the church is 900 years old, a bit older than the buildings in Vancouver, I've heard. And also, even older than that church, was their tradition of raising beef cattle. It was always a nomadic kind of thing, but what's cool, even in the modern day, it still is nomadic. Most people just keep a handful of cows, which I think is quite cool because in Europe, you're a farmer if you've got 4 cows. You know, here people seem to think you're a hobby farmer if you had 4 cows, but they recognize there that it's still a lot of work, any kind of farming that you do, and it's integrated into their lives, and they take care of these cows every day. Because what they do there is sort of through the spring, winter, and fall, every day they take them from the barn near their house and they put them in a little pasture nearby. And then during the midsummer, they cut the hay by hand, still a lot of people in this village, and they stack it up to dry. And they just leave it outside for the winter. They pile it up a bit higher than that around these poles. And then the cows, though, meanwhile, have been up in the mountains for the summer. So they go everywhere that you see in this slide, even these really steep mountain sides. They're very adventurous, truly free range. And those little stone structures at the bottom there, that's called brañas. Up till about 40 years ago, that was the summer village. Everyone in the village we lived in went up the mountain with their cows. The cows still do go up the mountain. They walk them up that road from our village. It's about 4 kilometers. And then they come up and check on them all the time. This is one of the summer houses, and they just build them out of what is at hand. It is quite warm in the summer, so they just heap up some stones, put some gorse that's just growing around the house on the roof. And this is one of the high mountain pasture areas. So it's just tradition. Each village has a specific area on each of these mountains. Like back there, there's cows on that mountain as well from a different village. It's just protected now by what they call a natural park status. So they allow these traditional uses of the land, but it can't be developed at all. And then another tradition that they have in Europe that really helps protect local food is called the denomination of origin. So the government actually puts rules in place protecting both the ancient ways that foods are made and the ingredients they're made with. In Asturias, their most famous product is an apple cider alcohol. So it's very popular with people to try it out. It's very dry, made of heritage apples. But however you choose to drink it, I mean, because it's protected by a denomination of origin, that gives it a kind of cachet. And every tourist or even people from other parts of Spain come to Asturias, they try the cider. And the other thing that they used to do is, this is just right outside the house we were, a little primitive as you can see, but that's not a house, that's a food storage house made of wood. They protect their food in the winter months when it's rainy. And that whole hillside behind it, that was the food. All those are chestnut trees. Again, traditionally, each family in the village had an area on the hillside that were their trees. They didn't own them, but just everyone knew who went where. They'd pick the chestnuts, store them in the house, and the other thing they'd store would be spelt and other fruits. Basically, that whole landscape has been remade into their garden. If it's not a chestnut tree, it's an apple or a cherry or a plum. So they'd be storing all those foods. But unfortunately today, that's one of the things that's not protected by the denomination system, the chestnuts. So all that forest is just falling to the ground. People aren't picking the chestnuts anymore. So that's kind of what we realized when we were over there, that they do have a lot of these old traditions, but they're not being incorporated into the modern food system as people there get old who have the skills. So all of these cows that we saw around us, somewhere somebody was eating them, but we don't know who. We could not buy that meat in the grocery stores near us. We'd see all these little gardens with tomato, kales, onions near us, couldn't buy that stuff in the store. Backyard chickens near us, couldn't buy those eggs. So that's a real problem over there. If they're going to the supermarket, even if they buy the beans to make their traditional bean dish, which is the signature of the area, called fabada asturiana, those beans are from Bolivia now. So in actual fact, with the exception of some of these exceptional denomination of origin foods, like there's cave cheeses or, you know, things like ham that has to be aged for 4 years, and the pigs have to have eaten acorns in a forest. You know, it's very particular. Besides that, we actually realized when you go to a farmer's market, what we get in Vancouver, the produce is actually much tastier than anything we bought at any Spanish farmer's market. So we're actually very lucky here. We have a tradition of lots of organic farms, small-scale farms, and I think really good soil here. So we should really cherish the quality of the food we get here.
There's a book that recently came out called Empires of Food, and it looks at different societies that have had their food systems fail entirely. And the main researcher for that book is a Canadian guy named Evan Fraser. And I was talking to him about it, and he said that in the end he concluded that the strongest food system that's possible, really, is much like what Elisa was just showing in Asturias. And that is a system where they specialize in whatever the landscape is the very best suited to do. So in that case, the Asturian cattle. But there's also a great deal of other crop diversity. So in the case of Asturias, the spelt, the chestnuts, all the fruit trees, all of the small garden produce. And he calls it embedded diversity. So a diversity of crops embedded in a landscape that is also specialized to produce the things that it is very best suited to produce. The problem with most food systems today is that, you know, we're very good at the specialization part now, much, much poorer at maintaining the diversity part. For example, we all enjoy Okanagan wines, I think, but because of that, the Okanagan is slowly turning into one big vineyard. So they've been losing their grasslands, they're losing their heritage orchards. Real estate is really, you know, in many cases priced out of reach for anybody, any kind of farmer except grape farmers. The end point of that process is the Napa Valley in California. In 1968, grapes accounted for 26% of the agricultural production in Napa Valley. Last year, it was 99%. So they've started to look at it and say, well, is this a sustainable food system? And I mean, I've gone a couple weekends where I've had nothing but Cabernet, but you don't want to do that as a year-long diet, I don't think. So they're actively trying to reverse that now. And one of the groups they're working with on that is a nonprofit called California Farm Link. And they do a number of different things. One of the things that they're sort of most successful with is it's like an online dating service to link people who want to be farmers to the little patches of land where they might be able to farm. And I looked at it recently, and there was 160 different farming opportunities in California, none of which involved the purchase of land. So in each of these cases, it was crop sharing or leasing or partnerships, in some cases with vineyards. You know, some of the vineyards are inviting people to plant crops, for example, in bottomlands where grapes don't grow so well. So that's one thing they're doing. Another thing they're working on is, or have actually won, is a program to offer small, low-interest loans to people who want to start farms. And unfortunately, I mean, the great thing about it is that they have this program. They've won it. They got it from the government. The bad thing is that the government has approved the program, but no money for the program. So it's one of these things that exists on paper but has no money to support it. It's like the American economy itself in that way. They're fighting now to get that funding, and it looks good for them soon. The third thing they're doing that I think is interesting is they're linking older farmers to younger farmers. So in California right now, farmers who are older than 60 years outnumber farmers younger than 25, 60 to 1. So you can see there's a potential problem there. And what's typically been happening is that farmers reach retirement age and they stop farming. Their farms fall into disuse, and eventually they have to be sold for development because they can't keep up with taxes and so on. FarmLink is finding young farmers, connecting them to these farmers as they approach their retirement, and getting the younger farmers onto that land and farming the land before they're even close to being able to actually purchase the land, which is, of course, incredibly expensive. But the big thing that comes out if you talk to people in Napa is don't turn into Napa. You know, they just say, do not let your food system get to this level of specialization. So a strong local food system, it's not just about, you know, building new traditions or even sort of tapping into old ones. It can also just be about hanging on to what we have. And, you know, Vancouver has, lucky enough to have, quite a diverse food system still. So that should be part of our job here.
Well, this is my last point. When me and James did the 100-mile diet, sort of after we'd settled into our new patterns and gotten over the initial trauma of not being able to find things, we're like, if we're actually doing pretty good here, really the only thing we're missing is olive oil. If only someone could ship it up by sailboat from California, totally ecological, we'd be so happy. And we thought it was kind of a joke or a dream or something, but now it's actually happening. There's a company in France that started shipping wine by sailboat to the UK, and now they've made 2 trips to Montreal. So it's happening. I don't know. We're going to have to get that wine on the train or something to get it over here. But what's happening down with the group Sustainable Ballard is a different version of sail freight as well. Ballard is kind of a suburb of Seattle. It's really attached to Seattle. But they have the same problem Vancouver has there. There's lots of people who would like to buy organic food, but, you know, with urban sprawl, there's a shortage of farmland, land's very expensive. So they thought to themselves, why don't we start a cooperative and sail up to the Olympic Peninsula every 2 weeks, which is what they did all spring through fall. They did their last trip last week. They're probably glad they're not going this week. They went and got organic vegetables. And this is a perfect match, really, because the Olympic Peninsula is, by modern standards, the total boonies. They have nowhere to sell their organic produce to in their area. So instead of driving it all the way to Seattle, they're picking it up by sailboat. So they reported on Twitter their parts of their voyage. It takes about 12 hours, kind of depending on the wind. But you feel like you're there with them. It's quite neat. So they talk about how their last trip, their departure was postponed until 7:30 because they had to wait for low tide, and then they could just barely get their mast under the bridge. And then another trip, they had to row out of Squim Bay because there was no wind. And then they saw a sea lion and raced a ferry as the wind picked up to 5 knots, and they won. And they are very excited when they report back. We see Seattle, and you kind of imagine the skyline. And then they report, Ballard, your sailors and organic veggies are safely home. So you feel like you were kind of there with them. And then what happens? They pick it up by bicycle, the people who subscribed, after it has been brought to them by electric car from the docks. It's got it all. So I thought, you know, this would be a really good thing to do in the Gulf Islands. Because right now, Salt Spring is doing pretty well for itself. It's got a lot of farmers there. People support the farmers market. But on some of the smaller islands like Maine and Pender, land is still very expensive there, but there's not really a big enough population to support their farming. But Tsawwassen is only 26 kilometers away by boat from Maine Island. And that would be a really good way of reviving small-scale farming in the Gulf Islands and increasing the farmland that's available to Vancouver as well. It's not just coastal sail freight. Actually, one of the most inspiring ones that I heard about, it was one of the earliest ones, maybe 3 years ago, in the Kootenays. And there's a lot of communities on the Kootenay Lake. It's huge. They decided that they wanted to start growing local grain. They got excited by that idea. But because there's so many ecologically minded people there, the farmers on the lake said, okay, we're going to use horses instead of tractors to keep fossil fuel out of the equation. And then the local sailing club said, hey, let's carry that a step further. We'll deliver the grain so that there's no fossil fuel whatever in the system. So there's all these communities on the edge of Kootenay Lake that are extremely remote. Before, they had no one to sell to, really. But now they can sell to Nelson. So the first year of the project, they had 3 boats delivering the grain. And then the next year, they had 11 boats because they had so much more grain. They'd increased their subscription to 600 people and 100 pounds of grain for each person. And there's one final frontier in sail freight that I'm very excited about. It's not just olive oil. I lied that I wished I could have had when I did the 100-mile diet, 100%. Chocolate. In Brooklyn, New York, there is an artisan chocolate company called the Mast Brothers, and that's their real name. Maybe it inspired them to do sail freight. They have a boat lined up, the Black Seal. It's a 3-masted 70-foot schooner, and they're making a trip to the Dominican Republic in May and picking up 20 tons of cocoa beans. So I think, I don't know, me and James might have to move within 100 miles of Brooklyn.
So this is my last journey with us tonight, I guess. And for me, it's kind of maybe the most important too, and that's the idea of linking local food to ecological restoration, which is another, you know, big area of interest for me. And this brings us full circle back to the Vancouver area as well. And the food I want to talk about is a food called the Wapato. Some of you might have read about it in the Eat Your History series that I guest edited for the Taiyi. And the Wapato, I mean, prior to European settlement in this area, of course, there was no wheat, there was no rice, there was no potatoes. The main complex carbohydrate source was this aquatic tuber called the Wapato that grew in wetlands and riverbanks. This was not some minor food source. I mean, there was a study done in the Columbia River, which was also a Wapato area, and they found the waters just around one island in the Columbia produced enough Wapato to feed 31,000 people for a year. So this was a major food source, and it was also, you know, really a major part of our cultural history. People ate Wapato in this area for more than 4,500 years, and then in the last 100 years or so, it's mainly been forgotten. So this woman named Roma Leon decided she wanted to revive the Wapato, and I was lucky enough to go along with a Taiyi reporter named Joanne Will, and we went out on the harvest. So this is Mike Leon and Roma Leon. Mike's the chief of the Katsi First Nation, and Roma's a member of the Katsi as well, and they were traditionally sort of big Wapato culture in this area. And as you can see from the jackets and the blankets and so on, it's a pretty cold day because Wapato harvest season is right about now. And that's a little bit of a disadvantage because of this. To harvest the Wapato, you jump in the river, and I had my wetsuit with me, and I was wondering when Roma was going to change into whatever she wears into the river. And then, boom, she's off the boat in her jeans and socks. And so nothing to do but follow her. Traditionally, Wapato harvesting was only done by women. I thought that tradition would probably have gone by the wayside, but then I asked Mike when he was coming in, and he just was like, no way am I going to do this. So what you do to get the Wapato is you loosen up the mud with these sticks that we're holding, and then you just kind of, it's like you're stomping grapes. It's like you're a stairmaster, only while somebody pours jugs of ice water down your pants. So you do this, and you break up the roots, and the Wapato float to the surface. I actually got quite into it after a while, churning away there. And the interesting thing is that Wapato is a plant that actually benefits from being eaten. So what you're doing when you do this traditional harvesting is you're not only bringing up the Wapato, but you break up the roots, and chunks of root float down the river, and they start new Wapato patches. And Wapato right now are fairly rare. I mean, it used to be very, very common and abundant, but fairly rare now because people, you know, partly because we've been channelizing the river and draining wetlands and so on, but also because we stopped eating the Wapato. So we actually have this opportunity where if we were able to revive the Wapato, we'd also be restoring the historical ecology of this area. And not only the Wapato would be restored, and it is, by the way, a beautiful white flower in the spring before it dies off and becomes the tuber. But not just the Wapato would benefit, but there was a lot of things that ate Wapato. The Fraser Valley used to be a major, major area for canvasback duck abundance because they love the Wapato. So were we to start eating them again, we'd be benefiting at least those two species. So this is the first Wapato that floated up, and we were so excited when this thing came up to the surface. And then Roma waded over and said the reason it came up so quickly is because it was rotten. And this is our harvest. So I put this in here mainly to show the frost. This is how cold it was. This was our little Wapato harvest. It was just an experiment to see what might be out there, and that's what we found. And we took them home, and we cooked them up, baked them. They bake up about the same speed as a baked potato. And they taste kind of like potato, but sweeter, more like they've got a little corn or chestnut or something in there. You know, a wonderful food, and really no reason that it should have disappeared from our from our radar. But the thing I want to leave you with, I guess, is when we got those home, they were covered in river mud. And I was washing the mud off, and I was like, wow, these things smell funky. Like, they smell like sewer. This was a strangely poignant moment for me. You know, I think for me, through this whole process of local eating, the thing that's always been most impact, or had the most impact, is what I learn by connecting with where my food is coming from. And in this case, what I learned was, we're not treating that river very well. And it was amazing. I mean, that one day waiting around after Wapato really told me more about the Fraser River and what we're doing to it and how we might change that than reading 50 newspaper articles could ever do. So I thank Roma, I thank the Wapato, and I think Elise is going to take us out of here.
I mean, Vancouver has made amazing advances in local food in the last 5 years. I think if we were to try the 100-mile diet today, it would not be nearly so much of a challenge, because when we did it, there were no farmers markets all the way from October through June. Those were long months for us. And we couldn't find wheat for very many months, and that's just to supply two people. We had to make our own bread once we did find it, and we even had to make our own salt to go in the bread. Local seafood was, besides salmon, totally a mystery what was out there till a local fisherman, Steve Johansson, introduced us to the spot prawn. He didn't just introduce us to it, though. He introduced all the chefs in the city to the spot prawn, and now every year there is a spot prawn festival. That's how much more popular it's gotten. Now there is a winter farmers market every week, and we had to wait like 7 months between in the winter. And now you can keep beehives and chickens in the city. And just that alone, I mean, I looked up how much honey can you get from one hive, 100 pounds from one hive. I only use about 12 pounds of honey in a year myself. One heritage Chanticleer chicken lays about 200 eggs a year. You're allowed to keep four in any yard in Vancouver. So that's 800 eggs a year. I think that'll do for me and James. And then all we need is a yard to go along with it. We couldn't find wheat. We were on an involuntary Atkins diet, but now there's an urban grain cooperative. It supplies 225 people and 75 bakeries and restaurants. There's people selling 100-mile bread at the farmer's market now. There's a guy making 100-mile salt, the Vancouver Island Salt Company. There's even a wheat festival in Victoria. It's even possible to be 100-mile vegan now. There's a dried bean cooperative, so you can do it all now. And so I guess I just want to leave you with all that innovation and participation in food culture, really, because all of us are part of it by growing things, by buying things from our local farmers. So let's keep on innovating, and we can make Toronto eat dirt and local dirt. But thank you very much.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. That was James McKinnon and Alyssa Smith. Their book, The 100-Mile Diet, has set off a cascade of efforts in North America and beyond to support the production of local food. It helps save the atmosphere, makes your city more secure, and gives you more nutritious organic food. Please pass this Radio EcoShock special on to your friends, coworkers, and local government. We can do it and survive. You can download this program as a free MP3 from the food page at ecoshock.org. I recorded this talk at the Museum of Vancouver on November 25, 2010. My thanks to the speakers, the museum, Tai Magazine, and the Tides Foundation for this really worthwhile presentation. Find those links in my blog for this program at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our future together.
Yeah, that was the thing that surprised us when we started speaking in different communities about local food. We found that the local economy angle is actually what gets a lot of people on board with it, people who wouldn't otherwise consider themselves left-wing or progressive, even though the local economic angle of it is as political as anything. But definitely, I mean, we're basically remaking the economic system if we return to true local economies. It actually creates more jobs, keeps more money in the community. So we've had nothing but support wherever we go. Even the American Midwest has actually been one of the more supportive places of it, which you would not think. You know, if you follow American election coverage, they're like, oh, you know, the dreaded Republican middle kind of thing. But they're totally interested in the economics of the local.
It also had that it's it's politically interesting at a global level as well. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, one of the arguments that's often made around local food is that by eating locally, we're somehow, you know, dreadfully undermining the economies of people in sort of distant places in the globe, which, you know, frankly, is a brand new concern for global capitalism. But there's a wonderful book. I mean, I won't claim to be an expert in this stuff, but I will recommend a book by Raj Patel called Stuffed and Starved. And Raj is a great guy. I mean, he studied global food systems and, you know, globalization. And at the end of it, he now calls himself a locavore. And the principle is pretty simple, is that strong local food systems, first and foremost, should be the rule, and it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter if you're here, Indonesia, South Africa, the Dominican Republic, wherever. Strong local food systems as the first priority makes tremendous sense. And we've spent the last 100 years really slowly undermining local food systems throughout the globe, you know, through this process of globalization. So it isn't just a question of, you know, relocalizing here that in this place we think of as home, but also in all of these other places that have, you know, been supplying our food for the last 50 years.
This is Radio EcoShock going out with Dan Mangan, and he's been sold.
Suits had come for me. I found alternatives to honesty. Body and soul were bought and sold, patented and out of reach. So I reach, but it hurts, it kills, it screams, and it fills my heart with chills. And I take my pills, but I'm still tired of sleeping with the light on. It keeps the hair out of my eyes. Back it up and send it home. For just one stab at the good life, that's enough. And I'm so all my wretched thoughts and left them out for the less fortunate. Now at the gate I'll skip the queue. Life's not living unless you're sure to make it through. But now it hurts, it kills, it screams, and it fills my heart with chills. And I take my pills, but I'm still tired of sleeping the light on. Oh. But if it keeps the hair out of my eyes, pack it up and send it home. For just one stab at the good life, that's enough. And I'm so I'm sold.